May it please the court?
You may proceed.
As I said earlier, my name is Kenneth Kenny. It's an honor to be here representing Mr. Seck today in this appeal from the Labor and Industrial Relations Commission. Mr. Seck was wrongfully denied unemployment compensation because his employer, the Missouri Department of Transportation, failed to carry their burden of proof on the issue of misconduct. The commission's factual findings were insufficient to support a finding of misconduct. And when it comes down to it, because Mr. Seck did not act with the requisite mens rea required by the statute. In reviewing the commission decision, this court has said it looks at the whole record to determine whether there's substantial competent evidence. And in this record, there's no evidence to dispute the fact that Mr. Seck went back and forth from the doctor to his employer at least three times trying to return to work. There's no facts in the record to dispute that he got prior approval to miss work on August 3rd and 4th before he ever wrote on the note. It's also undisputed that he admitted he wrote on the doctor's note as soon as he was asked about it, and even his employer said the reason he did that is because he thought he was supposed to be absent from work until he finished his medication. These uncontroverted facts, combined with 60 years of case law and legislative history, show why this court should reverse the commission decision.
Now, couldn't the commission find that altering the note from the doctor to say he should go from August 2nd to August 8th is not misconduct connected with work?
Well, they found that he falsified the note, and that was the sole basis for their conclusion that there was misconduct.
And isn't that a finding of credibility? Are you arguing to us that that we should disregard their finding of credibility, that we're compelled by our standard of review to determine the evidence in the light most favorable to the decision rather than the light most favorable to your client, even though it seems reasonable and we might think that was what the proper finding is? Isn't that a credibility determination that we do not review?
Well, I think your question really invokes a number of issues. First of all, this court does defer to credibility determinations.
Absolutely.
But it should not construe those credibility findings broader than the commission did itself. And in this case, based on the plain language of the credibility finding, which is limited to one paragraph, it says claimant asserted that he wanted to return to work. However, the claimant changed his return date his return to work date from August 2nd, 2011 to August 8th, 2011, claimant was not credible. That's set out in three sentences.
They said claimant was not credible.
Yes, and it appears based on the language to be limited to his statement of whether he wanted to return to work. And in fact, we know that the commission themselves did rely on at least portions of the claimant's testimony.
A lot of your argument is dependent on the fact that our cases specifically say, because we look at the whole record, our standard of review of these kind of cases is different than in a court-tried case. We don't resolve all inferences or silences in favor of the result reached. We actually just read what they said. But we also defer to credibility determinations. So that kind of creates
conflict. In this case, the commission did find him not to be credible. But based on the language of their findings of fact on page 7 and 8 of the legal file, it appears that credibility determination is limited to his statement, I wanted to return to work. Now, additional evidence of that that's not in the brief, and I didn't realize it at first, but it still supports the point I make in the brief, is that inside the findings of fact on page 7, the commission itself relies on certain testimony that only comes out of the claimant's mouth.
Yeah, but aren't they entitled to rely on all part or none of the testimony of any witness?
Well, exactly. And in this point, their credibility determination indicates to us that they only disregarded his statement that he wanted to return to work. If they relied on portions of his testimony without explicitly stating which parts they disregarded and which parts they believed, this court shouldn't disregard more of his testimony than what the commission actually did.
But they didn't fire him. They kept him on. The employer kept him on for 30 days after he returned. I mean, it was clear from the alteration that he made that he altered the records, but they still kept him 30 more days doing the job he was doing before without any problem.
Well, exactly. His employer didn't come forth with any evidence at all that suggested there was anything else than the fact that he wrote on the note. They also didn't come up with any evidence to dispute the fact that he says he got prior approval. In the Court of Appeals below, the Division of Employment Security embraced that fact because there's nothing in the record to dispute it.
He says he talked to his supervisor and told his supervisor he wouldn't be coming in until Monday because he was still on meds. He did not get prior approval to falsify the note and make it look like his doctor had said it was okay for him to be off. Those are different matters, aren't they?
Well, they are different matters. Is that one is about writing the note, one's about taking the medication, but really, when your employer has already approved your absence from work,
it's okay to falsify documents then?
Well, I wouldn't
that's
say
not, I mean, not
I
saying
say
they had to fire
far.
Him, but why wasn't that a reasonable basis on which to find it was misconduct that he falsified a doctor's note?
Because that his act of writing on the note itself didn't harm his employer at all, and it didn't give him any benefit whatsoever.
Is that the test? What is the test?
Well, the test is that there has to be a certain level of culpability. I mean, that's really one of the issues that division's relying on in this argument, is it wants this court to change the law.
Do you have a case to that effect that there's got to be a certain level of culpability?
Well, I have, if I may, I have 51 years of precedent and a statute that lead to that result. In 1951, the legislature, for the first time ever, said employees who are fired for misconduct connected with work are disqualified from unemployment compensation, but they did not define the term misconduct. 3 years later, the Court of Appeals for the first time adopted a definition that was widely used in other jurisdictions, and that definition was applied for the next 50 years without judicial or without legislative intervention. And the Court of Appeals consistently held for 51 years that under any clause of the statute or of their definition at the time, there was a certain level of culpability. Statements like...
So your client wasn't disqualified. It was basically a six-week penalty.
Well, that is essentially the disqualification. The misconduct is a disqualification provision, and if he's found guilty of misconduct, then he doesn't get unemployment until he goes back and gets a new job, and then he would have to be fired again.
When was the current version of 288.030.123 in parens, which defines misconduct, adopted?
It was adopted by the legislature in 2005.
Okay.
But that's the
It only talks about manifest culpability after the third or, correct?
After in the negligence clause. Negligence to such a degree to or recurrence as manifest culpability.
So the first clause, it says, and at willful disregard for an employer's interest.
That's right.
So that all that has to be is intentional, right?
Yes.
Okay. What about deliberate violation of the employer's rules?
Well, that would be just what it says.
So, okay. Well, why doesn't the altering of the doctor's note fit into one of those two categories?
Because his act of writing on the note really didn't act against his employer's interest. His employer couldn't have relied on something that it didn't know existed yet. And the only evidence we have is that he didn't write the note until after he gained approval to stay home from work. I mean, this comes back to the issue that in order for the division to win this court really has to change its scope of review and start drawing inferences in favor of the commission, which less than 2 years ago this court says it did not do.
And we certainly say we don't draw inferences either way. We just look at what was found. But I thought they found under the third category a disregard of standards of behavior, which the employer has a right to expect of his or her employee, which must be different than the first two reasons. But why isn't altering a document from a doctor, why isn't that a disregard of standards?
Well, the standard of behavior is that the division's argument was violated was misleading your employer. I mean,
why doesn't an employer have a right to expect that if the employees will not mislead them about their reasons for being off work or alter documents without telling them?
Well, I think the employers would in most circumstances or in every circumstance have a right to expect their employees not to falsify a doctor's note. But in this case, that wasn't the basis for them allowing Mr. Seck to stay home. They didn't get the doctor's note with the annotation on it until after they had approved his staying home.
But didn't they fire him later? And I know he stayed on for 30 days.
Yes.
And certainly, but in fact, then they fired him once the hires up, as I understand it, the record indicates the people higher up realized that he'd falsified this note. Why doesn't that fit within that third reason? Even if it's not disregarding their interest, not a violation of a rule, because the rule says don't alter something. But can't you expect, as an employer, people aren't going to falsify documents and submit them to you?
Well, of course. But I think the thing that's missing here is a mental intent that he wasn't trying to deceive his employer.
But where does that? That's what I don't understand about your argument. Where does the mental intent come from when you're looking at three?
Well, at the third clause, I mean, the primary rule of statutory interpretation is to ascertain legislative intent. This court in 1976 in Kilbane said that we should presume the legislature acted with knowledge of the case law when it acts, and then in State versus White it said, when the language of a statute follows the language of the courts, it should be given the same meaning in both places. And the division won't deny that for 60 years that this definition has been used. Courts have consistently held a certain level of misconduct.
In some way, he was thinking about the employer's interest in thinking when he's on the medication, he wouldn't be as able as he might have been off the medication. So by altering this thing, he was trying to save the employer the fact that he on medication he wouldn't have been as good an employee.
I mean, well, that's exactly the issue, is that once he had a doctor's note telling him to go back to work, even though he had not spoke to his doctor to get that note, he had been running back and forth time and time again. He was already denied light duty. His employer already told him, you can't come to work while taking the medication. He's really stuck between a rock and a hard place. I mean, if he really didn't want to go back to work, all he had to do was not go back to the doctor.
Oh, so the employer is saying he can't come back to work while you're on medication. He's basically maybe confirming that point on ordering that note, I guess.
Yeah, the first time Mr. Seck came back to work, he requested light duty, and they said light duty is not available here, and you can't work while you're taking a muscle relaxer. The release form he got later is something that he tried to get multiple times. When he finally had it, he told his employer that he needed to finish his medication, and the only evidence we have is that his employer approved that. Given the public policy that's explicitly stated by the legislature that this law is supposed to be construed liberally to award compensation, and that this court has interpreted that to mean that disqualification provisions should be strictly construed.
When did the employer come to the conclusion that he had altered the form?
Well, yeah, and what we're arguing is that altering the form by itself, when it has no financial harm to the employer.
When did the employer come to that conclusion that he altered the form? When did they figure that out?
Well, when they asked him, and he readily admitted it. I mean, they don't deny that.
Counsel, you seem to be arguing that all of these require willful and wanton conduct, which ignores our decision in Findler that says the one that says negligence is enough. If it's reckless, clearly does not require willful and wanton conduct. Are you asking us to overrule that case?
Well, no, I think that what I'm arguing is consistent with this court's ruling in Findler versus Hudson, in that negligence is not enough. And what the division's arguing is that under this third clause, simply not paying attention to a standard of behavior is enough. That's negligence.
Well, the first one says an act of willful and wanton disregard. The second one says a deliberate violation. The fourth one says negligence to such a degree as to manifest culpability, et cetera. The third one says a disregard of standards of behavior which the employer has the right to expect. It's the only one that doesn't talk to us about the particular state of mind. Why is the state of mind necessary? Does it have to be his state of mind, or is it the behavior itself that justifies?
Well, there has to be state of mind, because when the legislature adopted this definition, that was essentially them approving of the court's application of the same definition for over 50 years, which required culpability.
Which never until Findler had broken out that negligence and intentional conduct are inconsistent. So I don't think you can take it that far. I mean, it says what it says.
Well, in the Western District Court of Appeals in Dixon versus Division of Employment Security, a 2003 case before the statute was adopted, the court went through a lengthy discussion of the third clause and found that it had to be at least a reckless indifference or conscious disregard, and that's consistent with what this court said in Findler. And in this case, Missouri Department of Transportation, by choosing not even to show up and provide testimony, did not satisfy the burden to show that he acted with that intent.
And I'm not saying accidental behavior, but if he intentionally did the conduct,
yes.
Why isn't that enough? As opposed to, you're implying an intent to have to harm or violate the employer or violate rules of the employer, as opposed to that the conduct was intentional and was a disregard of standards. They have a right.
Well, I'm not arguing that he unintentionally wrote the note, but what were his intentions when he wrote that note? The only evidence we have is that he intended to reflect his prior conversation and that he did not want to go to work and endanger himself and others. Missouri Department of Transportation was free to offer evidence that this note was required for him to miss work, but they didn't.
And in but fact, did the he commission contact the doctor to say, why didn't he just contact the doctor and say, well, I'm on medication, I'm really not ready to go back to work. Can you change, for the doctor to change his note from August 2nd to August 8th?
Well, when he finally got the last note, he didn't speak with the doctor because he had been back and forth three times in a matter of a couple weeks. In this case...
Whose doctor was it? Was it the Department of Transportation's doctor or his own doctor?
No, it was his own personal doctor, which added to the confusion because he asked for a workers' compensation doctor. He was denied that right. And the fact that he was using a private physician who was unfamiliar with this process with MoDOT and their special forms just added to his difficulty.
Did the doctor ever order him to finish all of the muscle relaxants?
Well, that's not really in the record. There is a prescription form that was rejected below and not actually evidence, even though it's in the record. And that says it's supposed to take it as needed. But there's no evidence that there was a conversation that medication should be stopped. And to assume that a release form intended for an employer is intended to convey medical advice to the employee is just wrong, because that wasn't the purpose of that document.
Is it unreasonable to assume that the legislature's intent in writing the statute was to further a public policy view that employees' fraudulent or forgery is not to be accepted?
Well, I think that if there was actually a forgery, that'd be misconduct, hands down. But in this case, if you look at the facts actually found by the commission, there's no intent to deceive. They didn't find that fact because because MoDOT did not produce that evidence.
Why is it writing on a script signed by a doctor forgery?
Because there still needs to be intent to deceive there. And that's what's lacking in this case. There's no evidence of his intent. There's no evidence that MoDOT relied on it. And those are crucial elements of a forgery. There's insufficient evidence to find that. And this
he didn't write on the note, I am now writing this note here saying, the implication is it's a doctor's note because it's altered. I mean, there's no other explanation on the note besides the fact it's on the doctor's note.
But there still must be a factor of reliance. If they're going to say it was misconduct because he forged a note, that they didn't rely on. I mean, you can't rely on something
that
hasn't
happened.
Well,
where is that reliance? I mean, if it was misconduct, he made it look like the doctor had said this and they didn't. I don't see where it requires disregard of the employer's interest or harm. It requires basically lying to the employer adequate, regardless whether there's damage to the employer as a result of the lie, I guess I'm saying.
Under the circumstances of the case, when a lie essentially is the basis for a finding of misconduct, what harm is a lie that doesn't do any harm, that doesn't get him any benefit, that even if it...
It might encourage lying where it did matter.
Excuse me?
Allowing a lie to go on uncorrected might encourage lying when it does matter.
Well, I mean, this court has the opportunity to say if there was evidence that this was an actual forgery intended to deceive his employer, that either harmed his employer or benefited him, that would be misconduct. But in this case, the entire body of evidence presented by MoDOT consists of a few sentences on page 54 of the transcript that does not allege any of that crucial evidence.
Are there any laws being violated by forgery to a state agency on a document?
Well, forgery
forging a document to a state agency, is there any laws saying that's not...
Well, I mean, forgery is a crime in Missouri, but you need intent to deceive. And in this case, there's no evidence of intent to deceive because, really, that note he wrote on the release form wasn't required for him to miss work. He was already allowed to stay home and miss work. And in order for the division's argument to prevail, this court must start drawing inferences based on facts or even based on evidence that's not in the record. And this court's already said it does not do that. It should stand by that and look at the facts actually in the record, the facts actually found, which are insufficient.
So as far as the employer is concerned, February 8th start was fine with them, February 2nd, August 8th was fine with them versus August 2nd, so it really didn't matter.
That's the only evidence in the record, is that they were fine with an August 8th start date. They never offered any evidence to dispute that, which really comes full circle to the credibility consideration we were speaking of earlier, and the fact that if the commission relied on part of his testimony, this court has no reason to disregard other parts. And where MoDOT bore the burden of proof, it's the only place where the employer ever bears the burden of proof is misconduct. We shouldn't be drawing inferences to relieve them of that burden. And that's really the main issue here. And if there's no more questions, I'm well over my time.
And there's no other evidence that he forged any documents regarding his inspection of bridges or the rest of his job? It's just this instance?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, if I may, the entire substance of the employer's evidence is, if I have that with me.
That's okay. You can come back.
I don't have that. But essentially, if I can paraphrase what they said, is that he turned in a note that said the word medicine on it was misspelled. They contacted a doctor. Doctor says I didn't write it. And as soon as he showed up to work, he said, yeah, I wrote that. I wrote that because I was still on my medication, thought I needed to be absent from work. That's it. Those facts alone don't provide the commission with any facts to find reliance or damage or benefit or any of the elements that would reflect his mental intent required by the statute, required by courts of this state for over 60 years. If the legislature wants to change that requirement, it's the legislature's job to do that. But so far, they've approved of the way Missouri courts have been doing it for 60 years.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have some time on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court.
There's
a problem with the facts as stated originally. There is no evidence of an agreement from the supervisor that he could have stayed off another couple days. The testimony was on page 19 of the transcript that he got that return to work, and the return to work is really what's damaging in that. It removes the restriction for the lifting and pulling. It also removes the medication restriction. And it also removes the driving of vehicles and the like.
But he couldn't have gone back to work while he was still on the medication, right? I mean, that would have been against the employer's rules for him to be driving machinery while on medication.
If the employer, the original restrictions, and they're in the legal file at pages 13
I'm just
and 14,
asking a different
they
question.
Put a restriction on, Your Honor.
Yeah, but I'm asking, could he, didn't his job...
We don't know what
I'm not
his
addressing
job required.
Counsel, I'm not addressing whether or not he needed to be on medication. I'm asking a different question. Was it your rule that you could not operate heavy machinery at work, which is what he did, if you were on medication?
There's no evidence on that,
okay.
Your Honor. And there's no evidence as to what he actually did at work, whether he did any driving or heavy machinery. I don't believe
I
so.
I thought there
but
was
I'm
when
not
they told him there, he couldn't there, go back for light duty because they didn't have any. All they had
yes,
things
there,
that...
And there was also pulling and lifting restrictions mm-hmm. on there also. And the doctor specifically put medication restrictions on the original thing, mm-hmm. and they said, we have no light duty. Then the doctor removed them. He says he called the employer, called his supervisor, and the testimony on 19 was, he says, the doctors cleared me to come back to work, but I want to take another couple days to finish my medicine, and so that's what I did.
And he wasn't fired for that conversation. Now, who's fired for writing something on the note?
That's true, Your Honor. Now, one would expect a supervisor for a state employee to say you need to do what the doctor says. There's no evidence as to what the supervisor said. One would expect the supervisor at MoDOT to say you need to do what the doctor says. If you disagree with the doctor about your medicine, go back to the doctor and get the note changed. That would be consistent with what happened there because the note got changed. But the note didn't get changed by the doctor. It got changed by him. The referee found and the commission adopted that it was a falsification. It was not just a mistake of failing to put your thing. If, in fact, that employer supervisor had authorized the additional 2 days, you wouldn't write that there.
The only thing they actually found he was not credible on is that he really wanted to return to work early, but he thought he couldn't? And we don't draw inferences to fill in blanks in the record. That's very clear from Big Hampton and so forth.
That's correct, Your Honor. It says claimant falsified the doctor's note. Claimant says that he wants to go back to work. The claimant is not credible. But if you start with the premise that he just doesn't want to go back to work, that puts everything in flux, and that he falsified it.
He did want to go back to work, but 2 days later.
Well, and doesn't the doctor's note change that time off, that additional 2 days, from personal time or vacation time to sick leave?
It would have if he told them.
If he had gotten away with it.
If he'd gotten away with it, he originally got away with it, and that was sick leave. They asked him in the trans. The referee tried to zone in on this. Were you on sick leave? Were you on annual leave? And I guess the next thing was going to be leave without pay or something. And he interrupted and said sick leave. He stole 20 hours of sick leave. Larceny by trick or device.
He had a right to that sick leave, didn't he?
Only if he's sick, Your Honor. Okay. Sick leave is unique in the sense that if somebody's sick, state employer can't deny you time off. Annual leave without pay is at the discretion of the employer. If I retire or leave separate, I don't get paid for my accrued sick leave.
So if he called up that morning and just said, I'm feeling really bad, I'm taking this medicine, I can't come in, that would have been okay. It was writing on the note that was the misconduct.
Well, that wouldn't have been a falsification of the note, Your Honor. Would it have been okay? I don't know. The employer might have said, you need to go back to the doctor about this, or come in. Had he taken that note in on the day, if he thought he needed the medication, even if he didn't talk to the doctor, had he showed up that day and said, I took my medicine this morning, here's my release, what do you want me to do? Well, then you've been honest with the employer, and the employer has a choice. Maybe they say, okay, don't drive the truck, or what they might do, or maybe they punish him, I don't know, but it would be a different situation here.
To follow up on Judge Wilson's question, is there any evidence in the record that this was the type of medication that he needed to take, that the doctor instructed him to take until it was all given?
The doctor wrote that it was muscle relaxants. There was something that didn't.
Needed?
I'm sorry.
As
elsewhere, it was shown as needed, but not at the in the actual transcript. But yes, there's evidence that it was muscle relaxants to take as needed. We're not talking antibiotics here that you have to finish your prescription on. And the doctor's note itself, I would say, removing that restriction, removing the statement of the medication, confirms that the doctor didn't think it was necessary.
Removing earlier notes that said he's on medication or you have to take medication.
The earlier note said has a restriction for driving cars and trucks. It's on page 13 of the transcript, and if you look to the bottom, there's a check where it says drive car or truck restricted. And then down in the bottom where it says list any restrictions related to prescription medications, it says don't operate machinery or drive while taking muscle relaxants.
And that was not on the last note.
It was.
It was.
He put it on.
No, but I mean it's written by the doctor.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, that's correct. It wasn't on. And I would say that's damaging in of itself. One of the attorneys in the office highlighted, says, if you look there, look where he put it. He didn't write up at the top, my boss agrees I have 10 more days, or even say I need 10 more days. He printed it in right where the doctor would have done it.
The Court of Appeals said there was no evidence in the record that the notation that was made by the claimant was misleading as to its source or was material to the employer or claimant's employment. Can you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. Page 56 of the transcript, you need only look at it to see that it's misleading. Look at where it's put. And what it says, it looks almost, except for that misspelling, it's exactly what a doctor would put down in there. In and of itself is proof of misleading. He didn't write, I need this or I need that.
What about being material to the employer or his employment?
Your Honor, he got 20 hours of sick leave that he didn't deserve. The doctor says he didn't deserve.
Wouldn't he have been denied those sick days without the notation?
I don't know, Your Honor, but I just talk about state employment. And if the doctor says you're, I'd say, Your Honor, the answer is yes, it would have been denied. The doctor said.
We don't know that from the transcript.
No, Your Honor, but we're all state employees here, and we know what the sick leave rules are, and we know that the doctor said he's not sick anymore, and the doctor doesn't have medication on here. If you go and show that to the employer and say, I'd like to stay home because I want to take medications that the doctor is not approving now, you get denied.
Counsel, can you address what state of mind he does have to have under that third standard? We're talking about whether it's material to the employer. Is that a requirement for a disregard of standards of behavior which the employer has a right to expect? Or is that implicit in saying you can only expect behavior, the employee to meet standards of behavior that are material and relevant to your work?
Well, Your Honor, there's differing levels of culpability, as this court is well aware. In this one, where we get into social, so we call it social mores, or what's expected, what the society expects, it says a disregard. I would say a lackadaisical attitude would be enough.
How do we know what standards and I mean, can they just expect you to treat your kids well or to make sure they go to school, or does it have to be somehow relevant to your work in order for that to be a basis for reflect badly on the employer or in some way?
Yes, Your
Honor.
You
don't go to church on Sunday, you can't get fired. I mean, how do you connect that?
There's been a number of cases, and even the statute elsewhere in the other part in the misconduct, it says misconduct connected with work. So it has to be connected with the work in some fashion. The fact that maybe you're not very nice to your children is not the situation, but maybe if you work in a daycare center and you beat your children, that might be. But yes, it needs to be connected with the work.
And you never made any attempt to prosecute for quote-unquote stealing sick leave or for forgery or... There was no attempt to prosecute this gentleman, was there?
The record doesn't reflect anything about that, Your Honor. In response to your asking earlier about forging some other documents, there's no record of any of that. I would think, though I try to stay away from the personnel work, I would think they'd correct that sick leave. I've seen Department of Labor do that with its employees. When they fail, there's a falsification, and they'll recharacterize the leave from one to another. As it relates to Judge Tuttleman was asking about, it took a month. There's nothing in there about why it took a month. I can just speak to my experience at the Department of Labor. A month is probably average for firing an employee. There have to be meetings, there have to be reports, there's memos going around, there's approvals, and then they have to draft a termination letter. And
what about the fact that as soon as he was asked, he said, oh no, I wrote that? How does that affect the analysis?
Once he got caught, what was he supposed to say, Your Honor? The employer had already called, when they saw that misspelling, the evidence was the employer had called the doctor to find out what's going on and asked the doctor, or the doctor's staff, did you write that on there? Was that written on there? They said, no, it wasn't. Then they went and challenged him. Now, we don't know how they said that, but they could just as easily have said, what's this doing on here? The doctor said he didn't do it. Who did it? Now, I'm speculating a lot. But at that point, he knew the game was up, and of course he said he'd do it. What else could he say? He couldn't say the doctor did it. I mean, I think...
So can you address again under Exception 3 what you think his state of mind has to be, or is his state of mind a factor for this court, his materiality? How do we apply that?
Well, Your Honor... It does say a disregard, and to the extent of a disregard, there is a certain amount, maybe the lowest level of mindset there.
Especially under the fifth clause of that statute, it says an intentional and substantial disregard.
So yes, sir.
Can we infer that whatever it is, it's less than intentional and less than substantial?
Apparently so, Your Honor. The Division of Employment Security is called on to look at that statute about 3,000 times a month. About 40,000 of these kind of disputes come up every year, and we'd like to be able to apply that as written and to do, as Your Honor has asked, Judge Wilson has asked, of well, this one says substantial, and this one says a disregard, and somehow to try to apply it as written. And yes, Your Honor, it clearly says that. I pose a disregard kind of in the thing of a lackadaisical of, yeah, I kind of know I shouldn't be doing that, but I just don't care.
But generally speaking, you're just, if it was not for the excellent work of the UMKC clinical program, there'd be no representation. These matters are so small, no lawyer would take these cases, and whatever you decide is final.
Well, Your Honor, there's plenty. The Court of Appeals, I understand we're their best customer, and they can be pro se's go up. I've certainly lost cases to pro se claimants. We get probably.
I did too, but I wasn't happy about it.
Well, I also dislike losing to anybody, Your Honor. But I think there's probably, by claimants, more than 100 appeals a month or greater than that. So it does go up, and they do look at it.
Three-fourths of which get dismissed on procedural grounds because they can't write a brief, unfortunately. So it's
frequently,
great that we
frequently,
do
but there's case law also, Your Honor, if they can glean what's being said there and the Court of Appeals wants to, the Court of Appeals can reach down and take it and resolve it.
Can I ask one more question? Do we clearly know from the record that the additional days for sick leave were approved on the basis of his continuing the medication? Or that they were just approved?
We don't know that they were approved at all in a fashion, Your Honor. He said he was on sick leave. We don't know what went through the employer's mind. He said he was on sick leave and the like. And apparently the record appears to reflect that the employer wants an off-work certification and wants a return-to-work certification. But, Your Honor, that's an inference for the trier of fact to draw as to whether he would have got it or not received it in these situations. And but even if it wasn't, let's assume for the sake of this that I used to work at a grocery store where we had no paid sick leave at all. But if you were off more than a certain time, they wanted a note in that because they had a schedule to fill. But anyway, and we had to, and they didn't want you working there when you were sick, and you had to present a note. And one time I did have to. I injured my foot and I presented a note. There was no doubt in my mind that if I changed that August 1 to August 7 by putting some on there to take some additional days, I wouldn't have been paid for it, but I would have been fired for it. When I went in at the time originally and said I got to have off and presented the note, they said, oh, can't you, we'll get you a chair and work the cash register or something. They wanted me there to work. So it's not a matter of whether they got the sick leave or not. It's a matter of these doctor's notes in and of themselves carry some special significance and importance to employers and claimants. And whether he got anything from it or not,
it's clear you didn't have a criminal mastermind in by misspelling the word medicine. I mean, this was not some diabolical scheme to defraud the state. You just, yeah.
Well, Your Honor, I might say it's a diabolical scheme by somebody that's not a mastermind. You hear about people robbing a restaurant while there's a police convention going on or something. I think it appears pretty clear that the employer, the doctor, did not approve additional time for medicine. He knew it. He altered it. Maybe it's a matter of he just wanted a long weekend, a four-day weekend. But no, mastermind, he misspelled the word. I went and looked in the dictionary and made sure about that spelling myself.
All right, there's no further questions. Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Kinney, on your way up, I want you to think about this question. You suggest that because there's a lot of case decisions throughout history that impose culpability mindset that we should just assume that every legislator, when they voted to pass this bill in 2005, imputed that rather than just look at the words of that statute when they voted for or against it. Why is that a more reasonable expectation than that they just read what the statute said and voted on the language?
Because this court has told us and instructs us that we should presume they acted with knowledge of the case law.
When they did that, isn't this knowledge that we're passing, isn't there some thought that we're now defining misconduct? That's a policy decision that we get to make. And they may very well have had knowledge of what the prior cases said, and they passed this statute without a mental state as it relates, or with different mental states based upon the different criteria.
The division referenced 100 appellate cases a year, or 100 appellate cases a month, and not a single one has taken the position or argument today that there's a lower level of culpability required.
Is there some case that I'm unaware of that says the disregard of standards of behavior requires intentional, willful intent to harm the employer or something like that?
A conscious or a reckless disregard has been found to be enough by Dixon versus Division of Employment Security. But I really want to draw attention to...
One of the things that bothers me about your argument is oftentimes in reviewing cases, law is imputed to new statutes. That doesn't make any sense when you look at the language of the statute.
Well, when the language of the statute follows what the court said verbatim for 51 years, there's a good reason to conclude that. Before I run out of time, I want to draw attention to the fact that the respondent stood up here and said there was no evidence of what the supervisor said in that phone call. That's the problem in this case, is that the party with the burden of proof failed to present evidence that would have resolved this. I mean, and the inference to be drawn, if any, is that the evidence didn't exist. And realizing the evidentiary deficiencies that MoDOT had, the division's arguing, he asked his court to look at documents that are not in the record, that were rejected, that are not part of the record. And that's legal files 13 through 16, the previous doctor notes. And if the court, I don't think that parties can agree for evidence to come in on appeal for the first time, but if they can, I invite that, because if anything, the four doctor's notes that he turns in, all they do is indicate that he was trying hard to get back to work, that he did go back and forth multiple times.
Assuming we read the record, as you said, and this guy really did want to go back to work, he kept going back to his doctor, and the doctor kept giving him the wrong note, and the employer kept saying, no, you got to get the right note, and he really did want to go back to work, although that is the one credibility finding that they found the other way, the commission. The fact is he falsified a note to his doctor. Why the heck he did that when he could have just not given a note, I don't know. But whether we would have fired him is not the issue. The question is, can you say it's okay to falsify a note from a doctor and that's not misconduct?
Well, I think in this case, the fact that he falsified the note only after the fact that anything happened. In this case, there was no evidence that the employer relied on. These facts, all the facts that MoDOT could have come forward with if they existed to satisfy their burden of proof. And in this case, gives this court a chance to tell the state of Missouri, if you do falsify a note, like in the six cases from other jurisdictions that the respondent cites, only one of which has the same statute as Missouri does, in every one of those cases, the employee was turning in a note to avoid being fired, had skipped work for 2 weeks and then forged a doctor's note in order to not be fired, had a policy, used the doctor's note from April in the Pennsylvania case, and used the same note two more times later. In this case, it's a very unique set of circumstances that he didn't write the note until afterwards. He didn't have to. He didn't even have to go to the doctor and get the note, and he would have sat at home forever.
Yeah.
And the question is whether he falls into the class of people who the legislature intended to be punished by being disqualified from receiving compensation when he was fired. And the facts and the evidence are not there. He was acting in the interest of his employer. He didn't want to go to work and operate machinery while under the influence of drugs that made him dizzy and nauseous and unable to control his body. If anything, he did MoDOT a favor by staying home. He doesn't fall into the class of people that need to be punished. And for that reason, We ask this court to reverse the commission's decision.
I just want to, before you sit down, say that, your composure here is great. Both counsel did a wonderful job in presenting the issues on both sides. I'm such a good job that I often forgot you were a Rule 13 student because you argued like an experienced attorney, as did your opposing counsel. And I just want to thank you both for the really fine job you did in presenting the issues.
Thank you, Judge.
And I also want to compliment UMKC for providing this program where people would otherwise not get representation.
Yeah. Well, it's an honor to be part of that program, sir.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. The matter will be taken under advisement.